You're listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 21st of June, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and this is The Big Interview, the programme where people with extraordinary lives, powerful careers and great tales sit down to tell us what really happened, how they made it and what makes them tick. John Hegarty is one of the world's top advertising men, one of the bright minds that created commercials and emboldened brands in the 1970s, and one of the entrepreneurs that put their own name above the door of the advertising agency in the 1980s, when he co-founded Bartle Bogle Hegarty. BBH bestrode the next two decades like a colossus, making groundbreaking, memorable work. Vorsprung durch Technik for Audi, Nick Kamen's Laundrette striptease for Levi's, and has made a very good mockery of lad culture while spraying on the link. Effect. But advertising's changing, and Hegarty has been an outspoken critic of the safe international style of creative that comes from brands and agencies being run by bean counters rather than bright sparks. Whereas Heineken used to refresh the parts other beers couldn't reach, is now imploring the thirsty to open their cities. Whatever. John Hegarty has some strong views on the good, the bad, and the ugly of the advertising world. John, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, Mad Men would have us believe that the golden age of advertising was many moons ago. People that work in the industry, people that own some of the most successful companies, as you do or run, would have us believe that it's today and it's tomorrow. But can we say that for British advertising, at least, there was a golden age?
I think there was no question that I think advertising in the UK came out of a shell in the 70s. I always say that, you know, the 60s didn't happen in advertising till the 70s. We had this amazing revolution in music, in fashion, in painting, and all kinds of things that was just incredible in the 60s. But in advertising, it was controlled by, really, sort of, in a sense, corporations, because they were buying the advertising. It took them some time to catch on to the fact that the world was changing. So the 70s, and I sort of think the 80s, were a time when British advertising really emerged as a powerful force throughout the world creatively. It became the admiration of the world. So in that sense, you can talk about the 70s and the 80s as being a kind of golden period for a type of advertising.
And is it a sort of about confidence? I mean, economically in the UK, there was not much of that in the 1970s, maybe too much of that in the 1980s. Is it very much allied to the swings and roundabouts of politics and economics, the health of advertising, or is it really down to the people that are writing those fantastic straplines?
Well, I think it was down to the people. Yeah. I mean, I think a sort of core of maybe 40 or 50 people who were key to the advertising industry of that era really, really made a genuine change. Because if you looked at it, the 70s were a disastrous kind of period economically. We had strikes, we had major problems all over the place, and winter of discontent. And then, of course, the 80s were completely the opposite. There was a huge amount of confidence, and the advertising was also quite amazing then. So I think it is about the people. The people can make a genuine change. And I think that's a great lesson to learn, that it isn't, we aren't just subject to the economic swings. We can fundamentally change things if we want to. And I think advertising showed that through those two decades.
You talked in your first answer about fashion and music and how maybe the 60s in fashion and music happened at least towards the end of the 1960s, if not in the 1970s, as you suggested was the case with advertising. Is that what you've always been attuned to? Can you only be ever good at advertising if you're tuned into what is happening, to the length of hemlines, to what's number one in the charts, to what people are doing? I know you've spoken recently a lot about not really wanting to hire anyone that has a pair of earphone buds in all the time because they're not picking up on any of the signals that surround them. Presumably that's important stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know, advertising, like anything, if you're a writer, if you're a painter, if you're an architect, you're trying to be a part of culture. You're trying to be a dominant force within culture. You're not just putting a building up, you're making a statement. I think the same with advertising. It is trying to be a part of culture. It doesn't want to live in a world called advertising. It wants to live in culture as we know it, in the broadest sense. So therefore, understanding that, being a part of it, being aware of what's going on is fundamentally important. And I have, you know, one of the things that drives me insane with creative people is seeing them walk around with their headphones on. Because I think you're cutting yourself off. You know, you're a communicator. You're absorbing all of this stuff that's out there and you're retransmitting it. And if you're cutting yourself off, how can you be a communicator? I always say to the creative people, look, you basically have any great creative career has 10 years. 10 years when you do your great work. And that's fine if you're, you know, a musician and you're writing great music. And, you know, I always use the example, Mick Jagger can go around the world singing Jumping Jack Flash. And, you know, 30,000 people turn up and it's a brilliant song and you can go on performing it. If you work in the communications industry, you have to come in every day and have a new idea. And it can't be like yesterday's idea. So you've got to constantly stay fresh. And how do you do that? How do you actually remain fresh? How do you not become cynical? How do you not cut yourself off? All of those things are going to sustain you. And if you don't do that, then you will have a very short career in our industry. And you can't go on repeating what you did 30 years ago.
Well, it's an interesting thing you should say. That's a great analogy. Because I wonder how the Rolling Stones can be self-referential. And they can even write songs. They have to have a couple of new tracks to take out on tour, don't they, every couple of years.
So everybody wants to hear, you know,
everybody wants to hear the old stuff.
You know.
Exactly.
Because that was when you were doing your great work.
Yeah, yeah, but how does that work for you, John? I mean, you know, you're the man that famously made Nick Kamen take off his denim jeans for that famous campaign and told Brits that they should learn to speak German to buy an Audi Vorsprung durch Technik. How tempted are you to use some of the similar leitmotifs or just achieve the same vibe in the work that you're doing now with BBH?
Well, I think there's a huge danger in sort of trying to repeat what you did before or think that you've sort of got a formula. And you can see it with, say, film directors. You kind of sense that they've got a kind of, I mean, for me, Spielberg had a formula and yeah. He kind of kept doing that and he was hugely successful. And as soon as the formula sort of ran out of steam, I kind of think he hasn't made so many successful films. I mean, I always say that, you know, I think Alan Parker was one of the great directors because he went from one kind of idea to another idea. You know, he starts with Bugsy Malone and then makes Midnight Express. And you think, my God, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And I think to be able to do that, to have that breadth, to have that ability to embrace new ideas is fundamentally important. So as a creative person, you've got to, on the one hand, you have a sense of this is how I'm going to do this. But if it becomes a rut that you constantly repeat, then I think you will fail. And the great thing is to be able to break a mold and move on to the next thing.
So it's good to get bored with things.
I think it really is. I think you have the courage to kind of break what you've done and move on to something different. And I think there's a sort of great superstition with creative people because you never know quite where has it come from. How am I able to do this? It isn't like I've studied harder than other people. It is a bit of a gift.
Yeah.
And you kind of think, well, if I change that, will I be as successful? And huge courage to do that. And you can see how sometimes it goes horribly wrong. And then you have to keep going. You have to go, right, that really didn't work. But I'm going to keep going. I'm going to go do my next big thing and I'm not going to worry about that. I'm not going to become safe because that's what, you know, failure encourages you to do. So you have to be fearless. I think as a creative, great creative person, you have to be fearless. Keep pushing the boundaries.
I want to talk a little bit more about the pure creative side of it later. But before we veer off into how you start your own company, BBH is obviously now a huge global empire. Before we do that, I want to ask you, who had the idea and how you kind of zeroed in on the black sheep, which is now your logo, BBH's logo, but it was for a Levi's campaign. Very simply, where do things like that come from?
Well, it came from the first piece of work we were commissioned to do for Levi's, and they wanted to launch black denim, and they'd booked some poster sites, and we had just been awarded the account, and they came to us and said, look, you know, we've got to get these posters up. Can you do a poster very quickly? And so I sort of came up with the idea of kind of, you know, black denim, focus on the fact that it's different, focus on the fact that it's not blue and that it's for people who want to go in the opposite direction. So consequently, you know, sheep all going in one direction with a black sheep going in the opposite direction. And then the writer Barbara Noakes added, when the world zigs, you zag. And that was the idea. And I remember presenting it to Levi's and they were deeply shocked because they looked at it and they went, oh my God, we've just hired these people. Where's the picture of the jeans?
Yeah, right. People, that's presumably client response.
And I sort of went, well, you know, people know what a pair of jeans is like. We want to just focus on the fact that they're now black. That's the most important thing. And we went backwards and forwards on this. And in the end, I mean, time was running out and the copy date was approaching. And they just went, oh, my God, we better buy this. And, oh, Jesus, what a disaster. And anyway, up it went. And they got a huge amount of applause for doing it. And the great-great-grandson of Levi Strauss in San Francisco, who was the chairman, Robert Haas, had it framed, put on his wall, and said, this is what this company should always be about. So it became a huge success. And they thanked me by going, thank you for forcing us to do that. And they gave me a black sheep, not a real one, kind of, you know, that you can sit on, a seat, sorry. No. And it became, therefore, a part of our culture. And then we adopted it. But I think what's interesting about that is that, you know, I often say to creative people, you've got to have a philosophy. What do you believe in? You don't just create. And your philosophy, I always say to them, don't worry about it. Don't try and Google philosophy. Oh, my God, I haven't got a philosophy. I better get one. It will come out of your work. Just let it happen. Let it happen. It'll come out of your work. And our philosophy came out of something we did for Levi's. It came out of our work. So the black sheep then became an emblem for how we thought and how we behaved. So that's how it came about and came about to be part of our culture.
Well, let's talk about, and that culture is the culture of BBH. Let's talk about founding that company, John, now, because that's the thing. When you go from being a hotshot creative to deciding to get a gang around you, in your case, two other executives, and form a company, what's that about? Is that about taking ownership of all the ideas you want to have? You want to make the money from them, but you don't want to have them filtered down by other people, other decision-making processes. Where did the idea to start the company come from?
Well, it's a sort of an element of all of those things, really. I was with my partners, John Bartle and Nigel Bogle, and we were the sort of the team running an agency called TBWA. We'd helped set up the London office of TBWA. We'd helped turn London into a very, very successful part of the agency group, became Campaign's first agency of the year. And there was a sort of growing sense that we were not being fairly rewarded. I don't think we were being greedy for what we were doing. And it gradually emerged that there was no way of changing the way that TBWA thought that they were going to go on treating us the way they had treated us. And they thought that was very fair and that was their right. We thought it was unfair. And it had gradually emerged that maybe what we should be doing is doing it for ourselves. And then, you know, all the other things fall into place, like, and then we can do, you know, set an agency up structured the way we would want to do it with the kind of clients, hopefully, that we would want to work with. In a sense, it came out of a feeling of being unfairly treated at the agency we're at, even though we were driving it. So that was the sort of motivating.
And wanting to break free, indeed.
And we thought, well, maybe we should break free and do it for ourselves.
And how old were you then when you started the agency?
I was 37 when the idea formed, and then 38 when we opened.
And what was life like? Because, I mean, people are going to want to hear tales of excess, of, you know, skidding your Porsche into the ram raiding your own office, you know,
I've never driven a Porsche. I kind of wasn't a Porsche person, actually.
But what was life like in Adland in the early 80s in London?
It was great in the 70s. To a certain extent, people kind of imply the 80s was all about excess, but you know, the 70s were pretty good in advertising because a group of people had sort of said, we can do this better. The 80s were, you know, we had this amazing freeing up, if you want to call it that, that Thatcher had done, where she'd privatized all these industries and all these big privatizations going on, and Gas, British Airways, all of these industries were being privatized. So there was a huge amount of extra work being done, extra budgets being touted around. But I'm not sure that necessarily made the work better. You know, if you look at the tightness of budgets in the 70s, in many ways, the work was just as good in the 70s as it was in the 80s. I always have been a great believer in, you know, creativity thrives with a bit of constriction, a bit of kind of restriction. And we always used to say, if you can't outspend them, then you have to outthink them. And we always kind of, at BBH, we tended to get brands who were a bit down in their luck. You know, Levi's, when we won it, was in a very, very bad way. Audi was kind of a sort of poor man's BMW. We worked on Whitbread, on some of their, when they were a beer company, on their brands that weren't working very well. And Boddington's wasn't exactly a big famous brand. And could you do something with it? So I quite like the idea of the underdog. I always think the underdog is more interesting, that can't spend the kind of money some people have got.
And you presumably a brand that is down on its luck is prepared to take a risk and wants to employ an agency that wants to take a risk on their behalf. So it can be balm to a creative's vanity, presumably.
Totally, yeah.
So for something like Boddington's, I think our international listeners may be Googling
on
YouTubing it as we're speaking,
It was
John.
A great, for those who don't know, it was a great beer that came out of Manchester. And we did this wonderful campaign for them, the Cream of Manchester. It was a brilliant campaign. It worked stunningly well.
But these were riffs on the creaminess of the head of the beer that you got. They were these beautiful things.
Yeah,
great
fantastic.
Art direction, lovely ideas, simple copywriting. Yeah. These are sort of classic ads of their age.
Absolutely classic. And they were, you know, I've always thought when you're creating a piece of work in advertising, actually, I've always said to people, I don't want to work in advertising. I want to work on a much larger canvas. I use advertising to get there. And so coming up or having ideas that kind of become a part of the language, become a part of the vernacular, is to me a great way of creating work, just as I think any great artist or any artist is trying to do. You're not trying to be just an artist, you're trying to be a part of culture. And we did that with a huge number of brands. But I think the idea of working on things which are, you know, brands which are the underdog is fantastic. It gives you a huge opportunity.
And of course, we'll tell the story of BBH again here, and now of course it's an international agency. You've got offices from São Paulo to Stockholm to Shanghai to Singapore. How does that work? Because, I mean, they're obviously very different markets. The idea of advertising is presumably to zero in on the vernacular, as you said, to become part of the culture. That's a challenge. People might say that, you know, it blands out advertising if you have to be able to sell a car to Brazilians as well as to Chinese people, that you don't get any subtle copywriting or the rest of it. But practically, how does that
work? Well, there
work
are two things there. Well, there's the one is the globalization of our industry, which is one thing. There's a lot of evidence to say that creative work today isn't as great as it was in other decades. And I'm not trying to do that. Oh, it was all great back then and now. This is a view that the audience we talk to take. The people we talk to say the work isn't as good as it used to be. So obviously there's something not working there. I think one of the reasons that it isn't as great is that globalization has occurred. So now I no longer create a piece of thinking that's going to talk to the British public, however you want to define that. But I now have to talk to a global audience. And it reduces the options that you've got. It sort of takes away a lot of the simple, the interesting vernacular, the kind of use of culture that I can put into my work that actually makes it connect with people. You know, if I said to people, well, nothing I did, but there's a wonderful example. Heineken used to have a great advertising campaign called Refreshes the Parts Other Beers Cannot Reach. And if I say that, huge number of people in the UK will understand that line. It hasn't been used for 20-odd years. Today, Heineken have got a line which is Open Your World. And you kind of go, is that touching anybody?
Yeah.
I'm not sure it is. And I think that so globalization has stopped advertising in a way connecting. Yes, it works around the world, but it doesn't actually connect with any individuals. And then you've got the ability with offices around the world to take your culture, your learnings into other markets. And that's the thing that we've done that we've been reasonably successful at. But it is very, very difficult getting that right because advertising is a very, at its best, is a creative business. It's a very emotional, finding people who work together, who can emulate and be a part of the BBH culture if they're not in London is very difficult. So that's in a way why we've only got 8 offices around the world. We haven't got 80. It's been incredibly difficult finding those hugely talented people that can come together and be a part of what we believe in. It's very, very hard.
And taking a risk and being witty and being the Cream of Manchester or being the Nick Kamen Levi's advert, doing that in the UK is zeroing in on a particular way of speaking, a way of behaving, a way of knowing which envelopes to push.
I think this is the thing with global advertising. I mean, you know, you look at any of the great work we did. You know, obviously the Cream of Manchester, you could argue, well, it could have worked, but it really resonated with people in the UK. You know, Vorsprung durch Technik. We were sort of having a little joke about how you speak German. Well, obviously that wouldn't have worked in Germany, and it probably wouldn't have worked in lots of other markets. It's only because the British had a relationship with Germany that was very, very specific that we were able to play off. And so those things get sort of watered down as you go global. And I think my genuine belief is that global advertising is just not working. Yeah, it's fine for Calvin Klein. It's fine for Apple because, you know, they're creating a global brand that genuinely is talking to people in the same way. But I think when you come down to a beer or you come down to something which I have a kind of a local relationship with, and everybody's trying to kind of be global, who shouldn't be? They should be attempting to be local. They're going in the wrong direction. And you see brands trying to do that shouldn't do it. Fine for a perfume, fine for an apple. But, you know, if you're a toothpaste or if you're a beer or if you're whatever, you know, you want to talk to those people, as individuals.
And well, let's talk about one of the elephants in the room whenever people are pitching for new business. That must be Apple. When we were in the green room before we switched on the microphones, before we started this interview, you said something that surprised me, how much you actually liked the advertising. And you made an interesting point. It's the creative, but more so it's their use of how they use old media to tell the story of their very new media company.
I think it's amazing, isn't it? We're living in a world today where, you know, literally I'm so many avenues have opened to me to communicate with people. And in this sort of opening world, this digital world that we've all watched and witnessed, we've forgotten how powerful old media is. And almost if you suggest using it, you're kind of almost castigated into the sort of rubbish heap of kind of advertising history. And yet the most successful brand, the most technologically advanced brand there is out there, Apple, uses kind of posters, press, TV, PR to communicate its brand message. And it has no social network side. It doesn't have a Facebook page. It doesn't use digital media in a way that other brands leap into. And I think what it exudes something called confidence. You know, I mean, I laugh slightly when, you know, they launch a new phone and what's the headline? And we always used to struggle over the headline, but that was where the idea was. The headline is iPhone 6. You know, I mean, how long did that take to write? You know, but what they demonstrate, which I think is brilliant, is absolute confidence. And you can see Samsung trying to do it, but they add a bit more with like, and the camera's got 58 pixels or something like that. And you go, no, guy, you've just lost it. You know, you've just tried to put a bit more in there. And the confidence just to say it's iPhone 6 and that's it. Creatively, I'm not falling over it, but I am admiring its confidence. But I do love their campaign for the camera, which is just taken on iPhone 6, yeah. These beautiful pictures. It says everything without saying anything.
What I think people would love to know as well, John, is what's on your desk, actually, is what you work with, whether you work with the back of a notepad and a stubby pencil, or whether we've sort of talked about the lack of sexiness of certain elements of the digital sort of side of doing business here in 2015. But what do you need to have the great idea that sort of launched these 1,000 ships?
Well, you need inspiration, obviously, and you get inspired by a brief. You know, somebody walks in, and that's what a great planner will do. That's why, you know, you work with teams of people, but they are a kind of part of a team who hand on the kind of project. They think about it. They inspire you. They say, this is the way of thinking about this. And I then take that on. And I always say to people, I do my best thinking when I'm not thinking. And I get so dismayed when I see all my creative people sitting in front of a screen and they're flicking through YouTube or whatever they're doing. And I just think, you know, sitting down and talking to somebody is the most incredible thing you can do. And I always say to people, you know, come in. What you need to do in the morning is come in. Because we still work with kind of art directors and writers, roughly. And, you know, I say to people, what you need to do is not switch on the computer, but switch on that person. Because that person has got, you know, hopefully lots of unique thoughts, ideas that you could plug into. With yours, you'll create something and you'll go into a space that nobody else has been in. And that's the most brilliant thing to do. So when you're working, what you're trying to do is develop a conversation and you just start talking. And it's the most brilliant thing. And you go off into all sorts of areas and suddenly out of this, an idea will come. It'll connect. You'll go, wow. You won't get that looking at YouTube, or you won't get that flicking through Google or anything else. But, you know, once it's there, it's been done anyway.
And I wondered also where business is done. Is this pubs of Charlotte Street still thronging with people shouting ideas over each other? Or has advertising changed a little bit in that respect?
Yeah, sadly it has. It isn't as social as it used to be. And I'm not saying that was fantastic or anything, but there was a sense of exchange of ideas in a way which was really interesting. And now people kind of are locked into their offices, or if they're in an office, they're in a big long, not in an office anymore, they're in a big long line with 50 other people around them. And no wonder they put headphones on and watch the TV screen because there's so much noise. And I think we've lost that sense of a kind of an environment where ideas are exchanged and people are kind of bouncing off other people. I always say that the most wonderful creative environment I ever worked in was at art school. It was just fantastic. You know, people worked in corners on stuff, but you went over and chatted to them and then you went away and you left them. And it was just, you were coming across people doing all sorts of fantastic things. You weren't all trying to impose, but it was the most wonderful creative environment. And I think, you know, when I look at a lot of agencies and I see how they're laid out, and they're like a bloody call center. You know, all these people in line with the headphones on and looking at a computer and anything. Where's the conversation? Where's the, I saw last night on TV, or I read this, or I saw that, or I went to see this, and that was interesting. And so people are picking up on it. I mean, that's a great sadness.
In terms of those ideas, I mean, they're still being had. They have been had in a different way. Maybe they're being had without the conversation. Maybe they're emblematic and symptomatic of this sort of globalized world. But I wonder how, and I ask this of songwriters and painters as well, but your business is different because you have those, your cuddly paymasters, the clients in the middle of the original idea and the end execution of it, I suppose. But tell us this, I wonder, John, how much a great idea changes from the moment of having it to seeing it on the TV or seeing it on the billboard. You know, I mean, obviously, as we say, they're tempered by clients' expectations, but presumably not much when they're really good.
Well, I think lots of industries are in the same place we are. If you're a movie director, the same thing is happening. If you're an architect, the same thing is happening. You're, you know, the client's imposing it all kinds of ways with budgets, with attitude and with everything else. And it's up to you to try and preserve the integrity of the idea. And you kind of also, the great conundrum you have is you never quite know, was that a sensible idea or was that a dreadful idea? And it isn't until you explore it that you kind of can work that out. But you're always trying to hold on to the integrity of the thought. You know, that idea I had in my head, when it exploded into my brain, how can I keep that emotion, that thought, to sort of be able to communicate it? And that's the skill of a creative person, is that I've had the idea, now I'm going to communicate it. That's, in a sense, what we're doing, is you're having this brilliant idea, hopefully brilliant idea, and then how you communicate it is just as important. And one feeds off the other. And holding on to that with a client imposing thoughts on you, budgets coming in, and it's always a struggle. But I think if you're a film director, it's the same thing. Or if you're a theatre director, if you're an architect, you know, how do I hold on to the integrity of what it was I was trying to create? Or a car designer, you know, all the same things happen. We're not the only ones that go through that. I think in the end, everybody has a client somewhere.
Yeah.
Some more pervasive than others. But in life, I've worked out you always have a client.
You always have a client somewhere. And before you go, I'm sure our listeners would be interested to know what brand or maybe what industry you'd get your teeth into. What's, whether it's an underdog or whether it's something that is just fundamentally weird and needs to be sort of brought up to speed.
Well, I'm going to answer that in a slightly different way, which is what I'm doing now. I've started an incubator company called The Garage, where great ideas start. And what's really exciting is I'm now spending all my time helping businesses start up and grow. And what we're actually saying is a group of us have got together, finance, marketing, advertising, strategy, to kind of help these businesses. And what we say is The Garage isn't about starting a business, it's about building brands. And I'm finding that really exciting, really. So you're looking at people coming in with these initial ideas. We're providing them with seed funding to get them going if we like them, and we take some stock for our involvement. But it's really exciting seeing and using your creativity to help a business get off the ground and become a brand that becomes very successful. And that's what I'm really doing now. And actually, in a way, we're completely agnostic in the industries we're looking at. I've always said, you know, when people say to me, oh, what brand would you really like to work on? I've always sort of said, a brand that wants to change the way people feel or think. And so if somebody walked into me and said, John, you know, I make nuts and bolts, but I want to change the way people feel about nuts and bolts because actually they hold the world together. I go, that's the brand I want to work on.
John Hegarty, thank you so much for your time.
Robert, pleasure.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bounds, talking to John Hegarty. Tune in next week to hear Monocle's Georgina Godwin meet the performer Will Young. Thanks for tuning in.